From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson Tuesday offered to engage in direct talks with North Korea without precondition, an apparent departure from the previous policy of talks following denuclearization.
We've said from the diplomatic side, we're ready to talk anytime North Korea would like to talk. And we're ready to have the first meeting without precondition. Let's just meet. We can talk about the weather if you want. We can talk about whether it's going to be a square table or a round table if that's what you're excited about. But can we at least sit down and see each other face to face?
But Tillerson said there would first have to be a period of quiet without nuclear and missile testing. Stephen Norper, senior director of the New York-based Korea Society, called the statement long overdue and a step toward resolving tensions.
North Korea has held off on some of its testing. Up until the November 29th test, there had been almost a 75-day hiatus, and so Washington is signaling that it wants to see a similar type of pause in missile and nuclear activity to show seriousness to get to the table to negotiate.
Meanwhile, UN Undersecretary General Jeffrey Feltman, who met with senior North Korean officials last week, said they did not offer any commitment to talk, but left, in his words, the door ajar. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini acknowledged Tuesday Europe should have acted sooner to deal with the migrant crisis in Libya. But she told the European Parliament in Strasbourg Tuesday progress is being made.
Thanks to our work, to the work of the European Union, we have assisted over 15,000 migrants that now have been able not only to go home, but to start a new life.
She said the EU plans to empty Libya's detention centers in the next few months following video footage that showed some migrants being sold into slavery. This is VOA News. French President Emmanuel Macron delivered a bleak assessment Tuesday on the global effort to fight climate change in remarks to more than 200 global investors and 50 world leaders in Paris, saying the effort is being lost. The French leader warned many of the leaders attending the meeting Tuesday will not be there over the coming decades. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was also present and said it's time to move on from fossil fuels.
I have heard it said that the Stone Age did not end because we ran out of stones. We don't have to wait to run out of coal and oil to end the age of fossil fuels. We need to invest in the future, not the past.
World Bank President Jim Yong Kim, referring to the 2015 Paris Climate Accord, announced the bank would stop financing oil and gas exploration and extraction after 2019. U.S. federal prosecutors announced terrorism charges against suspect Ukayad Ullah Tuesday, a day after the 27-year-old Bangladeshi immigrant allegedly detonated a pipe bomb in a New York City subway tunnel in what authorities say was an attack inspired by Islamic State. Jun Kim is acting U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York.
The complaint filed this morning charges Ullah with 5 counts of federal crimes.
Those charges include bombing a public place and using a weapon of mass destruction, providing material support to the IS, destruction of property by means of an explosive, and using a destructive device in furtherance of a crime of violence. The worst of Southern California's fires is creeping ever closer to the hillside community of Montecito. Frank Palmieri is a Santa Barbara County resident.
It's pretty devastating. I've lived here for 25 years, been through quite a few fires. This one, I think, has surpassed all of those other experiences in terms of the devastation and the impact it's had on the area.
The Thomas Fire, which broke out December 4, has already destroyed hundreds of homes and blackened nearly 1,000 square kilometers of land. It's classified as California's fifth largest blaze ever. Poland's new prime minister, Mateusz Morawiecki, promised to maintain the government's right-of-center Law and Justice Party's commitment to social welfare, but also had a message for the European Union: don't try to fit Poland and the European puzzle incorrectly. He said that will destroy both the puzzle and the peace. The EU has been critical of the government's judicial reforms and resistance to accept migrants. The 29-member Atlantic Alliance NATO Tuesday extended Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg's tenure for 2 years until late 2020, giving the 58-year-old former Norwegian prime minister a rare 6-year mandate. In the southern U.S. state of Alabama, Democrat Doug Jones upset Republican Roy Moore in an off-year Senate election to fill the seat of now Attorney General Jeff Sessions. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Campaigning has begun for Liberia's much-delayed 2017 presidential runoff election.
I am pleased to announce that the 2017 presidential runoff elections will be conducted on Tuesday, December 26th, 2017. Accordingly, campaign for the runoff elections is hereby declared open.
Jerome Kokoya is chair of Liberia's Elections Commission. West African countries are among developing countries to get billions of dollars of World Bank climate change financing. The United States is considering reevaluating its relationship with Zimbabwe. And Burundi launches a controversial referendum campaign to change the constitution.
President couldn't launch such campaign without previously consulting the Bureau of the Parliament. So I'm wondering what is going on.
Agathon Raza is the deputy speaker of Burundi's parliament. Somalia aims to break this cycle of famine by building resilience. Guinea-Bissau to grant naturalized citizenship to all registered refugees on its soil. And a Botswana court orders the government to accept the identity of a transgender woman. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's 2017 presidential runoff election will take place on Tuesday, December 26, 2017, according to the country's Elections Commission. Chairman Jerome Kokoya took note of the fact that the vote is taking place the day after Christmas, but he called on all registered voters to make one more sacrifice for the good of Liberia's democracy. Liberia's Supreme Court last week denied an appeal for a rerun of the October 10th presidential election and lifted the ban for the runoff to take place. The court said the four political parties, including the ruling Unity Party, that challenged the results, did not provide enough evidence to substantiate their claims that there were massive irregularities. But the court ordered the commission to clean up the voter registration roll before the runoff. Here is Elections Commission Chair Jerome Kokoya.
Pursuant to the mandate of the Honorable Supreme Court of Liberia to the National Election Commission, I am pleased to announce that the 2017 presidential runoff elections will be conducted on Tuesday, December 26, 2017. We realize that this date is immediately after Christmas Day, but call on all registered voters to make this one sacrifice for the good of our democracy and country. Accordingly, campaign for the runoff elections is hereby declared open and will close at 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, December 24, 2017. We call on the two political parties in the runoff election, the Unity Party and the Coalition for Democratic Change, to go about their campaign in a peaceful manner. I am also pleased to announce that the technical team of ECOWAS that review our final voter roll will be returning to the country today to provide any technical assistance needed with the implementation of the mandate of the Honorable Supreme Court. Ladies and gentlemen of the press, the commission wishes to assure the two political parties, that is the two political parties in the runoff, the Liberian people, that we will implement all accounts of the Supreme Court mandate in a transparent manner and will keep all stakeholders, including the parties in the runoff election, updated every step of the way.
Jerome Kokoya is chair of Liberia's Elections Commission, speaking Tuesday in Monrovia. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza has officially launched a referendum campaign to amend the country's constitution. The current constitution derives from the 2000 peace agreement signed in Arusha, Tanzania, to end Burundi's civil war. The so-called Arusha Accord states that no president can govern Burundi for more than 10 years. But as Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura, the referendum scraps the two-term limits that sparked protest in 2015, and if approved, President Nkurunziza could stay in power for 14 more years.
In Burundi's capital, Gitega, is where President Pierre Nkurunziza officially launched the campaign for the country's second referendum since 2005. Burundi president had earlier this year formed a 15-member commission to draft the new constitution, with the presidential term expected to be changed from 5 to 7 years. Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza, while in Gitega, said that the Home Affairs Ministry should quickly reveal the dates for referendum campaigns. He says that the political leaders are called on to show a good example of patriotism, which is the pillar of democracy. President Pierre Nkurunziza says that it is the first time since the country gained independence for a democratically elected government in Burundi to fully serve the mandate. In the new draft constitution, the president can only serve not more than 2 consecutive terms, and he can legally contest in a presidential election after another president serves at least 1 term in the office. The country's constitution was in the center stage of the political crisis since 2015, when the presidential term limit being a major talking point. Among the articles that was amended in the constitution is Article 96 that limits a president to run for more than 2 terms in the office. Burundi opposition leader and deputy speaker of the parliament, Agathon Rwasa, said that the move was illegal.
President couldn't launch such campaign without previously consulting the Bureau of the Parliament. So I'm wondering what is going on. The project of referendum itself is still concealed. Nobody knows what is in that draft. Why do they conceal it so that much? And why do they want to do things in haste?
According to the Burundi opposition leaders, it is evident that the incumbent president is paving his way to contest in the 2020 presidential elections. Burundi last amended the constitution in 2005, when the incumbent president Pierre Nkurunziza took the office after the transitional government that was led by Domitien Ndayizeye. The constitution that included the 2000 Arusha Agreement sparked controversial interpretation between the opposition and the ruling party that led to the violent protest in 2015. Majority of Burundians stayed away to comment on the referendum, but one of the citizens who preferred not to reveal his name said that the move only serves one party.
The issue of referendum also, I think, will be a very tough question because, first of all, I go back from the time it has been put into place. It has been a negotiation. It has been a referendum from different parties, and now it's going to be amended by force.
As Burundi is now eyeing to fully fund the 2020 general elections, political analyst predicts that the ruling party, CNDD-FDD, are more likely to win the elections due to the fragmented opposition. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
The United States is considering re-evaluating its relationship with Zimbabwe following the resignation of former President Robert Mugabe. However, the U.S. is proceeding with caution, according to a hearing by the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, due to the mistrust around new President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Mdumiyake Mwakalele of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports.
Several members of the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations probed a panel of experts on Tuesday that comprised a representative from the U.S. State Department, an opposition party leader, and a human rights lawyer, and an author, all from Zimbabwe, on the prospects of re-engagement now that there's a new leader at the helm. However, the opening remarks by the presiding senator, Jeff Flake, who described Zimbabwe as a nightmare and questioned how much change can be expected under President Mnangagwa, indicates that change may be long in coming.
President Mnangagwa is not unknown to us. Until his dismissal as first vice president last month, he'd been closely allied with President Mugabe since Mugabe's rise to power. He stands accused of orchestrating a string of massacres in the early 1980s to consolidate Mugabe's power, leaving as many as 20,000 people dead in Matabele land.
Reference to the atrocities of the 80s in the Matabele land and Midlands regions, also referred to as Gukurahundi, were raised by almost all the Senate members, namely Democrats Cory Booker of New Jersey and Christopher Coons of Delaware, who also wanted to know what kind of reforms can be expected under Mnangagwa.
I think it's critical that the people of Zimbabwe not see one dictator replaced by another. And so I for one, am reluctant to see us take any steps to lighten or relieve sanctions or other international restrictions on loans or partnership until we see concrete steps by the administration of Emmerson Mnangagwa and any successors.
To that, Honorable Stephanie Sullivan of the Bureau of African Affairs in the U.S. State Department, who was one of the panelists, gave the following key reforms that would signal a change from the U.S., including the lifting of sanctions.
As far as governance goes and respect for human rights, we would like to see immediate implementation of freedom of expression that has been lacking for decades in Zimbabwe, freedom of assembly. We are looking also for a free and responsible media, including social media, the preparations for the elections, that as I mentioned, anti-corruption.
Asked what they would like to see the U.S. do to ensure that true democracy takes place in Zimbabwe and that Mnangagwa and his government will be held accountable for their actions, human rights lawyer Dewa Mavinga urged the U.S. to work with African bodies such as the African Union.
The U.S. administration could strongly push the Southern African Development Community and the African Union and other players to insist on a roadmap for democratic elections, and to then say, as my colleagues have said, that a key benchmark really to review relations is an independent assessment of the environment in which the 2018 elections are held.
Opposition party leader Tendai Biti of the Progressive Democratic Party and the MDC Alliance stressed the importance of the U.S. staying engaged. Reporting for VOA's Zimbabwe service, I'm Dimyake Mokalielie in Washington.
Today's Wednesday, December 13th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. A senior United Nations official says Somalia is taking concrete steps to break the recurrent cycle of humanitarian emergencies by building more resilient institutions. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than a quarter million people in Somalia died in 2011 when drought turned into famine. Despite multiple warnings of a looming famine this year, a similar catastrophic event did not occur. The UN Development Programme Somalia Country Director George Conway says this clearly shows that famine is not inevitable. He says famine can be prevented if concerted action is taken and the underlying conditions of famine risk are effectively addressed and targeted. He spoke on a telephone from the capital, Mogadishu.
This year, despite drought conditions that were quite significantly worse than what we saw in 2010-11, famine has nonetheless been prevented. And this is a result of many factors. The government's early declaration of a national disaster, the UN's early call for upfront funding to prevent a famine, a quick and generous response from international donors, and a massive scale-up of assistance all contributed.
Additionally, he says progress in state and institution building, more effective governing institutions, and investment in stabilizing key regional capitals have enabled a more robust response than was possible in 2011. The United Nations is appealing for more than $5 billion to provide life-saving assistance for nearly 3.9 million Somalis next year. Conway says for the investment requirement, which includes recovery and longer-term resilience building, about $1.7 billion will be needed over the next 3 to 5 years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Guinea-Bissau declared this month that it will grant naturalized citizenship to all registered refugees on its soil. Anne-Marie Deutschlander, the United Nations Refugee Agency's deputy representative in Western Central Africa, tells Ricky Stryak the move is an impressive gesture that other countries can emulate.
Guinea-Bissau contacted us, our office, last week. We have been negotiating this for some time, but contacted us and said that they had decided to make a declaration to naturalize all refugees that are on their territory as a means of local integration and a way to end a protracted refugee situation.
And are these refugees mostly from the south of Senegal?
Yes, I would say the great majority are rural refugees from the Casamance. They're up here, but this declaration is actually extended also to urban refugees. It's really quite amazing, I have to say.
And how many refugees are there estimated?
The number is something that we need to, let's say, agree on, because there are two databases that are currently circulating. We have the UNHCR database and we have the government database. So we'll need to agree on their exact figure.
And why does this help refugees? Are these people living without papers right now? What does this give them access to in their day-to-day life?
Well, first of all, this ends the status of being a refugee, which is obviously one of the main objectives for UNHCR. We really encourage people not to be lifelong refugees. So this is what UNHCR calls a durable solution. Meaning that they are not going back to their own countries and they're not being reinstalled someplace else, but they are staying in the country that granted them asylum in the first place. It's for us really the final stage of local integration is to obtain naturalization. So by being naturalized, of course, then they become citizens like everybody else. There's no more difference between their rights and obligations between those of citizens. This obviously has consequences in the one sense. As a citizen, you have rights, but you also have obligations. But since these groups have been very much locally integrated into the local communities that they're currently living in for years and years already, we don't see that this is going to be an issue because we have a lot of local integration projects and we work with a partner. And those projects are always intended to serve everybody in the community. It doesn't just distinguish between the refugees. It's always also going to help sort out some of the land issues because this has been a big issue and the government of Guinea-Bissau has also included this in the declaration that they've signed, was to regularize some of the land issues. And, of course, once you're a citizen, you can also vote and you can take... The children already go to school, but it's really more, I think, a question of your refugee status has ended. You're not going to be a refugee anymore, now you're a citizen. And another thing which I would like to point out, which I think is notable in this case, is that both Senegal and Guinea-Bissau recognize double nationality. So this is also a helping factor because no one will have to give up their Senegalese nationality to become a citizen of Guinea-Bissau.
Do you know why? I mean, what the impetus was, if this has been in the works for a few years?
It's not something that's completely out of the blue. We've been working on it for quite a long time. I think maybe some of these efforts paid off. One of the things I think that may help them also was that we've been discussing the issue and the fact that Guinea-Bissau, as a small country, could make a great gesture.
And Marie Deutschlander is the UN Refugee Agency's deputy representative in Western Central Africa. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. Business and political leaders pledged billions of dollars in funds and concrete steps to battle climate change at a summit in Paris held 2 years after the groundbreaking climate deal signed in the French capital. While the United States is the only country to pull out of the agreement, the U.S. did not go underrepresented, as Lisa Schlein reports from Paris.
French President Emmanuel Macron, the summit's host, wanted a practical meeting, and he got it. The climate-fighting pledges announced Tuesday included more than $10 billion in European Union investments for sustainable development and vows by companies and financial institutions for greener action, including some phasing out coal investments. Then came World Bank President Jim Yong Kim.
Today, we're announcing that the World Bank Group will no longer finance upstream oil and gas after 2019.
Kim also announced billions of dollars in financing for developing countries and cities battling climate change, including West African coastal areas. The Senegalese seaside city of Saint-Louis, for example, will get $250 million in funding to tackle coastal erosion that has wiped out homes and fishermen's livelihoods.
There's not a single African head of state who hasn't told me that the boot of climate change is on their necks. They feel it every day.
More than 50 world leaders attended the summit. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was one of many who warned that the international community was falling behind on climate pledges, including allocating $100 billion in financing for developing countries by 2020. Meanwhile, emissions levels are rising, Guterres warned, as are severe storms and droughts.
We are in a war for the very existence of life on our planet as we know it, but we have an important ally, science and technology.
U.S. President Donald Trump considers efforts to fight climate change a barrier to economic growth. His administration's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement leaves it isolated. Even Syria has joined the pact.
Et si on est là ici aujourd'hui, c'est parce que beaucoup ont décidé de ne pas forcément...
While President Macron described Washington's withdrawal as a blow, he saluted local and state politicians and business leaders in the U.S., including California Governor Jerry Brown and former New York mayor and businessman Michael Bloomberg for stepping in to fill the gap. On Monday, Macron also awarded grants to more than a dozen U.S. climate researchers to pursue their work in France.
Et donc quand je dis qu'on est en train de perdre la bataille aujourd'hui, je veux que vous preniez conscience que derrière moi, il y a des chefs d'État et de gouvernement.
Macron painted a stark picture of what he said the planet will look like if not enough is done. Some of the leaders in the room, he warned, come from countries which will be wiped out in 50 or 100 years, along with their populations. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A human rights group in Botswana is welcoming a Botswana court decision ordering the government to accept the identity of a transgender woman as a female. Shepo Reki Kusatayo had sued the government for refusing to change the gender on her identification card from male to female. The court ordered the government to change the ID from male to female within 7 days. Cindy Kalemi, executive director of the Botswana Network on Ethics, Law and HIV, says the court ruling is a positive indication that there is a progressive movement in Botswana towards recognizing the rights of transgender people.
As the Botswana Network on Ethics, Law and HIV AIDS, BONELA for short, and I think the entire LGBTI community in Botswana, we are very excited and very happy about the outcome of the current case where Ms. Reki Kusatayo was basically challenging the government of Botswana for refusing to recognize her as a female person who is transgender. So to us, this is an indication that there is quite progressive movement in terms of recognizing the rights of transgender persons and also sexual rights. So we are very excited that as a country, we are warming up to the idea that sexual rights or gender rights are actually human rights.
Cindy, do you find that this case is different from homosexuality? Because the court says here that it is still illegal to engage in homosexual acts in Botswana.
Absolutely. It is different. That is why I was saying even the religious people, they are more sympathetic to gender identity because everyone believes that it is natural. With sexual orientation, there is this perception and attitudes around the idea that some people just choose to be different. And therefore, why should we allow each and every choice, even those that are outside of God's law? But what we are saying is that in terms of the law, for instance, even when you look at sexual orientation, you would recall that Botswana was one of the first countries, again, in Africa to recognize that the LGBTI community has a constitutional right to form an association. That case was also won at high court level, even at court of appeal level. So it goes to show you that our court system really, really upholds human rights.
Cindy Kalemin is the executive director of the Botswana Network on Ethics, Law and HIV/AIDS. She was speaking with me from the capital, Habaruni. And that is it for this Wednesday, December 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Dave Magnus. I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a good Wednesday.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube,
Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. Believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.